How is life treating you as you came to church this morning? Now, I know we all have a public face. And maybe when somebody asks you, how are you? You say, oh, I'm okay. But the question I'm asking is, how are you inside? When you've closed the door and you're by yourself, what goes on in your heart? Now, maybe there is someone here this morning who's had a phenomenally successful week or a few weeks. You haven't had any illness whatsoever. Not a toothache, not a creak in any joint, no colds, no headaches. You have been perfectly healthy for a whole month. In work, everything has gone gloriously well. You've first of all given a pay rise, which was totally surprising. And then before you'd got over that shock, you were given a promotion. And you were delighted because it seemed to sort out so many of your economic problems. And then when you came to other issues at home, like a new recipe, well, you'd always wondered whether you should try this new recipe. And you did, and it turned out to be a gastronomic extravaganza worthy of winning MasterChef or the Great British Bake Off. Or a DIY job, the one which you'd always put to one side because it seemed to be too difficult. You finally got down to it, and wow, didn't it turn out to be a big success. And then spiritually, well, the devil seems to have forgotten about him. You haven't been tempted for weeks. And then when it came to witnessing, everybody you've spoken to have been dramatically converted on the spot. We would wish it were so. I imagine that for most of us here this morning, life is not like that at all. When it comes to health, well, we've had all the minor ailments. We've had the colds, and we've had the stomach aches, and we've had the aches and the pains. And then for some of us, maybe there are bigger issues of health, which are deeply worrying and scary. Maybe you've had some scans, and there are operations ahead. And then as we get older, there is dementia. There is Alzheimer's, and we begin to wonder when we find ourselves getting a little bit forgetful whether maybe these things are creeping in upon us. And we do wake up at night and worry about them. And then when it comes to work, well, it isn't a question of being promoted or having a pay rise. It's a question whether we're going to be made redundant because austerity hasn't totally departed Wales yet. And if you're on tax credits, there is a worry what the government intends to do about them, which means you won't be able to make ends meet. And then maybe you did lose a loved one in the last few weeks. And there is sorrow. And there is grief and there is pain. And when you shut the door, there's loneliness. Having to deal with being by yourself. Having had maybe a life partner by your side. And then there are other family burdens. You're concerned for your children, your grandchildren. We live in a very immoral society and we see them taken up by all these things and we wonder what's going to come of them. What will our children be taught in schools in the coming years? Will we have to take them out of our schools? Will we have to have Christian schools? Will we have to have home tuition? All these issues are coming up. And then in society, when we look at the state of the church, we're not setting Wales on fire. Christianity has been marginalised. A survey, which I read yesterday, said that one third of the population of Britain think that Jesus Christ is a mythical figure. That's totally depressing, isn't it? And maybe behind this public facade that we are jolly, good, happy people, there are all these worries and concerns deep down in our hearts. And that's who we really are. And we are worried. We are anxious. We are despondent. We can be depressed. So what do we say to one another? Well, there's a little chorus in there which we sing. Turn your eyes upon Jesus. Look full in his wonderful face and the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace. But what does that mean? Sounds very good, doesn't it? Turn your eyes upon Jesus. But where is he? What does it mean to turn our eyes upon Jesus? How can that make the things of earth grow strangely dim? How will it help us through the real problems of life which are behind that public face which we have? Where is Jesus Christ? Well, that's why I read Acts chapter 1, verse 1 to 11. He is ascended back into heaven, and he is seated at God's right hand in glory. He is the ascended and glorified Christ. So when we sing that little chorus, which maybe is a little bit sentimental, turn your eyes upon Jesus, where are we going to turn our eyes? Well, we turn our eyes to heaven, to the one who is seated on the right hand of God in glory, the ascended Christ. Now, this event in the life of Christ is one possibly which we can neglect a little. And because we neglect it, we neglect also the consequences of it, and are deprived of the consequences of his ascension back into heaven. Now, Luke, in chapter 1 of Acts, which I read at the beginning, tells us about that event. Luke also tells us at the end of his gospel about that event. And there are other individual references here and there in the New Testament to this going back into heaven of the Lord Jesus Christ. Now, the fact that we are evangelical nonconformists means that sometimes maybe we tend to neglect this ascension of Christ. Now, if we were Anglicans, the church calendar would give us an Ascension Thursday. So at least once a year we would read the story of the Ascension, and we would think a little bit about its consequences and the effects it should have on us. But it is one of the big five events in the life of Christ. Now, all of the life of Christ is important, but there were five big events, weren't there, in his life? First of all, his birth. And here we do follow the church calendar and give much attention to his birth at Christmas time. Then there is his baptism in Jordan. Again, maybe slightly neglected by us as to what are the consequences and the meaning of that event. Then we come to the crucifixion, which we, of course, remember in the Lord's table on a regular basis. Then we come to the resurrection, which we remember every Sabbath morning because we meet on the first day of the week when Christ rose from the dead. And then there's the ascension. And maybe, again, an event in the life of Christ that is neglected by us. But it's an important event. It brings to a close Christ's earthly ministry and marks his return to the place of honor at his Father's right hand. Now, to talk about the ascension of Christ maybe is not really accurate, because if you notice in our reading, the words that were used, that he was taken up. When we say that Christ ascended, he is the subject of the verb. He is ascending. But what Luke tells us, no, he was not ascending. He was taken up. It was somebody else who was active at that point. It was God the Father who was taking him up. He was taking him back into heaven. The Father had sent him into the world to be born of a virgin in Bethlehem. And now the Father is taking him back. That is, he's totally happy with what he has done here on earth. His earthly ministry has been concluded and is successful and effective. But it signifies also the beginning of his heavenly ministry. And that, you see, has all manner of ramifications and consequences for those of us who are Christians. What is Christ doing now? Because, you see, we don't deal with one who is dead. And although alive, he is still there, alive forevermore, at God's right hand in glory. Now, what I'm going to do this morning is merely going to deal with one aspect only of the heavenly ministry of Jesus Christ. And the one in particular that is of comfort and help to us in all the difficult problems of life which all of us have to deal with, and most likely hide from other people, but we know about them. That's what we're going to deal with this morning. Because there are hard experiences in life, aren't there? There are temptations that come our way. There are these worries and cares that we have. There is uncertainty about the future. And there is the possibility here in Britain of real opposition to the Christian faith. If you've read the front page of Evangelicals Now recently, you'll see about these thought police. And the possibility not only may we have a particular view about what is right with regard to marriage, but there could be a day when we can't say it. We can think it, but not say it. Things are changing. That's the society we're living in, and it's of a concern. It's a worry. And then, of course, doubts come to us and unbelief. And it's very easy to become hopeless and despondent and depressed. And so we ask, well, what comfort is there this morning as we turn our eyes upon Jesus? This is not just a sentimental little thought. We are turning our eyes to the one who is seated at God's right hand in glory at this very moment. And how does that help us? Well, it helped us to begin with, and I just mentioned a basic truth to begin with before we get down to details, that we have a living Savior. He is not a has-been. He is now seated at God's right hand in glory. Now, the fact that he sits is often told us in the New Testament. We have, for example, in Colossians chapter 3 and verse 1, the word is used there about this return of Christ to heaven and as to what happens to him. You remember, and he sits at God's right hand in glory. Now, the word sit seems to imply a work done. You know, somebody's been out in work all day, and although maybe you are sitting in work, you come home and you sit. And that's a different sort of sitting, isn't it? It's the sitting of relaxation. It's the sitting of tiredness, a work done, a day accomplished, and you sit. And in a sense, when we think of Jesus Christ sitting on the throne in heaven, we can think of it in terms of a work done. Now, it's interesting, isn't it, when we read in the Old Testament about the tabernacle and the temple later, that there was no chair in the tabernacle or the temple, because the high priest could never sit down, because his work was never finished. He had to go back continually, day after day, with sacrifices, year after year with sacrifices. He could not sit down, so there was no chair. But when Christ returns into heaven, he has completed his work here on earth, namely a sacrifice, a total sacrifice for sin, for believers, when he died on the cross of Calvary. And so he sits. The work is done. It's finished. He said so on the cross. It is finished. It's done. And so he sits. But it's not a deck chair. He sits on a throne. And from that throne, he conducts and carries out his heavenly ministry for the sake of his saints and his church here on earth. That is, the blessings that he won through his death on Calvary now have to be applied, as it were, to believers and to the church here on earth. Now there are many aspects, as I say, to this heavenly ministry of Christ. So don't come to me at the end of the service and say you didn't mention this or that, because I'm not going to mention everything. I'm going to confine myself merely to one aspect of his heavenly ministry this morning, which should really make a big difference to our lives. Turn your eyes upon Jesus. Look full on his wonderful face as he sits there. And what is he doing? Well, the one we are going to think about this morning is his intercession on our behalf. Now, we are told this more than once in the New Testament. We turn, for example, to Romans chapter 8 and verse 34, and we read this: "Who is he who condemns? It is Christ who died, and furthermore is also risen, who is even at the right hand of God, who also makes intercession for us." We can move on to the Epistle to the Hebrews, and we move on to chapter 7 of the Epistle to the Hebrews in verse 25, and we see the same thing there. "Therefore he is able also to save to the uttermost those who came to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them." And then you can move on to the first epistle of John, chapter 2 and verse 1. And we read there of an advocate with the Father. And what does an advocate do? Well, he argues a case, doesn't he? "My little children, these things are right to you, so that you may not sin. And if anyone sins, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ, the righteous. He intercedes. He advocates our case before the Father. Now, I'm aware here that some of you read big theological tomes. There are some who think that the very presence of Christ in the presence of God is the intercession. The fact that his finished work was so complete that just being there is enough. I find a problem with that view because I think these verbs are active verbs. When the New Testament tells us he is interceding, you get the impression he's actually doing something. When the New Testament tells us that he is an advocate, you have the feeling that he's doing something. That it's not just that his presence there is sufficient, but that he is still active, as it were, on behalf of his people here on earth. And so that's the question we're going to be asking ourselves this morning. I asked the question at the beginning, how is it with you as you came to church this morning? And maybe by now you're being honest with yourself and you're saying, I'm struggling. And so what comfort is there this morning for us when we turn our eyes upon Jesus, that the one we're looking at is seated at God's right hand in glory, interceding on our behalf? Let's break it down. First of all, this morning in heaven, we have someone who remembers us. Before his crucifixion, he taught his disciples that he was going away. I'm going away, he said. But he is not going away to forget. He is going away to remember. For how can he forget those for whom he died on Calvary? Very early on in my Christian ministry, I was going away on holiday. And there were problems which the church was facing at the time. And I remember one of the members saying to me, go away, they said, and forget. And that's what holidays are all about, isn't it? If you take all your baggage with you on holidays, all your worries and cares, it won't be a holiday. That's why people go to exotic places so they can forget about Britain and its dreary climate and all its problems and so on and so forth. You go away to forget. That's holidays. But when Jesus Christ goes away, he doesn't go away to forget. He doesn't go away on holiday. He goes away to remember. And that's a comfort, isn't it? We are living in a society where we are not being remembered anymore. It seems people want to rewrite history. And the Christian traditions of Britain, people don't want to remember them anymore. People don't want to remember about the effect that Christianity has had on our culture and on our laws and on our way of doing things. They want to forget. And it's a comfort this morning to know that if society forgets us, there's one who remembers us. I don't know if it's happened to you when you've gone through difficult experiences in life. Maybe a bereavement or some trial or tragedy. And fellow Christians come to you and say, we're remembering you. And what they mean is, we'll be praying for you. And it's a great comfort, isn't it? To know that fellow fallen human beings are with us, as it were, in the problem. They're remembering us. That's great. But it's greater this morning when we say to one another, turn your eyes upon Jesus, who's seated at God's right hand in glory this morning and remembers us. We are not a forgotten people. Because how can he forget those for whom he shed his blood on Calvary for their forgiveness of sins? How can he forget those whose God's wrath he took upon himself in order to propitiate that wrath? How can he forget those that he mediated a peace between God the Father and those individuals? He is in heaven this morning, my friends, remembering us. Secondly, the one who remembers us this morning is also one who understands us. I've met during the years, numbers of people come to me when life gets difficult and say, "Look, but nobody understands." What they're saying is, I'm going through experiences which nobody else has gone through. My experiences are unique. There's a bit of pride there, I think. And so nobody understands. But you see, the one who sits at God's right hand this morning, remembering us, understands us as well. Because what happens when Jesus Christ is taken back into heaven? Well, in a strange way, you see, more went back into heaven than came from heaven. The Son of God came from heaven. And then added to the Son of God is the Son of Man, humanity, his human nature. When he ascends back into heaven, it's not just the Son of God who goes back into heaven, but the Son of Man goes back into heaven as well. So in a sense, more goes back than came. Because now in the presence of God, there is one who knows fully human nature in all its weaknesses and with all its problems. That, you see, humanity was added to his deity in his incarnation. And he is never divided away from that humanity forevermore. It is essentially one person now for eternity. And as he sits in God's right hand in glory, it's not just a spirit. He is there in the body of his resurrected flesh. He is man. And what does that mean? Well, we're familiar, aren't we, with the words of Hebrews 4, and chapter 4, verse 14 and 15. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses or with our infirmities, but was at all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. He understands all our infirmities. Not just our spiritual infirmities, but he understands our physical infirmities. He understands our psychological infirmities. He understands our emotional infirmities because he has taken of human nature. And there he is in glory, remembering us and understanding us. And so in that sense, you see, he's able to empathize and sympathize with each and every one of us this morning in all the problems of life that we are facing. Sorrow. Joseph died very likely before he was 30 years old. I've met Christians who've had problems when their parents die rather young and seem to admire people who have parents who live on to their 80s and 90s. But Jesus Christ had to deal with the death of Joseph most likely before he was 30 years old. So there was sorrow in Nazareth when that carpenter died. Mary had to face the loneliness of widowhood and the looking after of Jesus and his siblings for a period of time. He knew what sorrow was. And then Lazarus died and Jesus wept. He wasn't always appreciated. Maybe there are some here this morning who you're not really appreciated by your children. They've taken it up against you a little bit. There are family disputes. In your place of work, your line manager doesn't appreciate you. Although you're trying to do your utmost and your best, you're not appreciated. He knew all about that. He was not appreciated by the religious people of his day. He was not appreciated as he went around. Indeed, he faced hatred. Maybe there is someone in work who hates you, literally. Or maybe there's someone in your family that hates you. They can't deal with your Christianity. They hate it. He knows all about that because he's been here. I met people who wanted to kill him because they hated him so much. Loneliness. It's hard, isn't it, when you close the door. It's all right to be, well, you can be lonely in a crowd. And you close the door and there's loneliness. And he knew all about that. When he went to pray in the Garden of Gethsemane, he left his disciples behind and he went alone to pray. And when he came back, they were asleep. He was by himself. And when he hung on the cross of Calvary, Wasn't that the utmost moment of loneliness? He looked to earth and earth didn't want him. And he looked to heaven and he said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? That was ultimate loneliness. He was standing alone. He knows all about it. And then temptations. When the fiery darts of the devil come our way and we say, oh, how am I cope with this now? He understands. He understands the devil better than we understand him, and he understands the fiery darts of the devil, and he knows about it all because he was tempted like as we are. And he was tempted even to disobey his father. In the Garden of Gethsemane, not my will, but thy will be done. That was the ultimate temptation, wasn't it? I'm going to do it my way, or I'm going to do it his way. That was the big temptation. And he did it his way. Went to the cross and died for sinners. And so you see, this morning as we come to church, with all our baggage, and with all our worries, and with all our cares, and with all our feeling being squeezed in a corner, and all our depressions, we turn our eyes upon Jesus, who is in heaven, God's right hand in glory, remembering us and understanding us. It's a great comfort, isn't it, to know that somebody understands what you're going through. It's a great start. But thirdly, he intercedes. He pleads or argues, if you like, or presents to his Father our needs. So, but what exactly is he doing? Now again, the verses in Hebrews chapter 4, I think, are helpful here. Because there we are told what we should be praying for. And we remember in those verses, we are told that we are to seek mercy and pray for grace in time of need. So when we go to God in prayer, there are two things we should be asking for: mercy and grace. Mercy to deal with yesterday. Grace to deal with tomorrow. Mercy because we fall. Mercy because we sin. Mercy because we leave him down. We need to be forgiven. We need mercy. But when we face tomorrow with all its problems and difficulties and hurdles, and we need grace. Now, if that's what we have to pray for, I'm sure I'm not going far wrong when I say that's what he is praying for as well. That at God's right hand in glory, we have one who remembers us, one who understands us, and one who is pleading on our behalf for mercy for our yesterday and grace for our tomorrow. Imagine the father turning to the son. And he says to the son, you know, there's this, that lady who goes to Heath Evangelical Church. She's not having a good week. She had a real tantrum early on in the week with her neighbor. And then when some Christians found out, she didn't tell the whole truth about the situation. And then because she was so upset herself, she didn't go to the prayer meeting. What am I supposed to do with her? And the son says to the father, be merciful. I died for her. I took her sins in my own body on the tree. I dealt with your wrath on her behalf. Yes, she has failed, but forgive her. Be merciful to her. And the father will say to the son, I hear you. And then the son will turn to the father and says, do you know there's that young couple who goes to the Heath Church? I'm concerned about them. The young man, he's been sorely tempted sexually. He has to go on the school bus where all his mates are on their phones looking at internet pornography. And he's trying to stand in that situation. And he is sorely tempted. Give him grace. And he's got this girlfriend. They're a lovely couple, both Christians. And they are really being tempted to go too far. Lord, give them grace. Because I died for them as well. I gave my life for them. I have dealt with all the sins of their past. And if they fail in the present or the future, I've died for those sins as well. But Lord, help them to stand in an evil day and still to stand. He is interceding at God's right hand in glory for mercy and grace. Isn't that a great comfort this morning? Turn your eyes upon Jesus. Ah, but where is he? Glorified in heaven. Remembering us, understanding us totally in all the problems of our lives, and pleading with his Father on the basis of his finished work on Calvary, that the Father will be merciful when we fail, and that Father will give grace to help us tomorrow. But fourthly, he remembers, he understands, and he pleads for each and every one of us by name. Remember the Old Testament when the high priest was to go into the Holy of Holies for the sacrifices? He would bear the names of the tribes of Israel on his breastplate. You remember how we're told that in Exodus chapter 28 in verse 9, we read this. Then you shall take two onyx stones and engrave on them the names of the sons of Israel, six of their names on one stone and six names on the other stone, in order of their birth. And when he went into the Holy of Holies, into the presence of God, the names, the tribes of Israel, were there being borne by him. And in that sense, of course, the high priest was a shadow of the great high priest to come. But when we turn to the New Testament, this is confirmed to us most gloriously in the 10th chapter of the Gospel of John. You remember those verses at the beginning of the chapter. Mostly, assuredly, I say to you, he who does not enter the sheepfold by the door, but climbs up some other way, the same as a thief and a robber. But he who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him the doorkeeper opens, and the sheep hear his voice. And he calls his own sheep by name. By name. And leads them out. And later in the chapter, in verse 14, I am the good shepherd, and I know my sheep. I know them. And I know them by name. So when he pleads for that lady who is a member of the Heath Evangelical Church, it's Mrs. Jones. And when he pleads for that young couple who are struggling in the immoral society this day, it's not just a young couple. It's David and Mary by name, because he died for them. And he knows each and every one for whom he died. And so he intercedes in this most personal of ways to God the Father. Now, we all have problems with prayer, don't we? And we all know there are occasions, aren't there, when we're too tired to pray. There are occasions where we don't know what we should be praying for. There are problems we have, we don't even see them, so we don't pray for them. And we have all these problems with prayer. But you see, the great comfort this morning is that there is one at the right hand of God the Father who's getting it right every time. He gets it right every time because he remembers us and he understands us by name and pleads for mercy and grace as we need in our day and age. And so we can sleep at night, because we know he's awake. Maybe you're too tired to pray, but don't worry too much. He is alive and well at God's right hand in glory. Sometimes we feel so weak, but he is almighty. We feel so lifeless, and he ever liveth. to make intercession for his people. How was it to you this morning as you came to church? Behind the public face, I'm okay, don't worry, I'm all right. It hides what many of us really are. And then we get the glib answer, turn your eyes upon Jesus. And we say, but what does that mean? It means we look to heaven, to the one who is seated at God's right hand in glory, who is now at this very moment remembering you, understanding you, pleading for mercy and grace for you, and for you by name. That's the savior we have. His ministry is not yet finished. His earthly work of salvation is complete and nothing can be added to it. But there is this continuing heavenly ministry of intercession for his people here on earth. So what's the solution this morning to our problems? Keep your eye on the one whose eye is upon you. For his name's sake. Amen.